Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello. Welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, this is Donna Sebo, and we are going to take an experience, an adventure that relates to the far north. For those of you who have been regular listeners to my show, you are very much aware that I've had a very strong association, a fond association, with the state of Alaska. And I've interviewed a number of people that have been in different levels of experience in that very unique environment. One of those men was Norman Vaughn, who was the last survivor of the Arctic expedition with Admiral Byrd. It was the very first expedition that was done to the South Pole. And I was amazed at what occurred just in the last 2 months. I have had the good fortune of becoming acquainted with a gentleman who not only knew Norman Vaughn himself, but also is a man that picked up someone else's dream and experienced it on his own level. This is about Vaughn E. Martin, who is joining me this morning. His book is titled A Long Way to Nome, The Serum Run 25 Expedition. Vaughn, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Donna. I'm delighted to be with you.
Life can be so serendipitous. In a million years, I would never have imagined that in giving a talk before a group, a business group, in Arlington, Washington, a talk that I titled Dream Big and Dare to Fail, which is a quote that Norman Vaughn is very famous for, and of course he was the subject of my talk, and to find afterwards a woman who comes up to me and says, oh, I can't tell you how much this has meant to me. My daughter just did a paper on Norman Vaughn. And then she goes on to tell me that she knows mushers, and the conversation was just amazing. Well, that happened that time, but then last week when I did the program before another group, I found two people in that audience that not only knew about Norman Vaughn, but were very, very much aware of his positioning in history with exploration. And the conversation with them after the program was just absolutely incredible. So here I have the opportunity to meet you. And of course, we've not met in person yet, but talking on the phone. And this man had a profound effect on your life as well. Vaughn, how did you get so involved with, one, mushing, and two, how did you come to know this man of history? Now, I bet you most people that are listening to the show have never, ever heard of Norman Vaughn, have no clue about his history. He was in his middle 90s when I interviewed him. And I know he passed away in 2005 at the age of 100 and lived for a couple of days after that. And that was his goal, was to live to be 100 years old. Tell me about your background with this man, because this is really an exceptional adventure. You were actually able to interview and to interact with history.
Yes, yes, I did, Donna. And I think the fact that you have received so much feedback about Norman during your talks really goes to how extraordinary and expanded his effect is on lives even outside of Alaska. He's had a profound effect on people really around the world. My introduction to the amazing world of running sled dogs and the relationship of unconditional love with sled dogs really began for me about 20 years ago with my first dog. Her name was Wolfie. He was a beautiful Alaskan Malamute, and she was really the genesis of my entire experience in the world of dog care, running sled dogs, and outdoor adventure. She taught me a lot during her lifetime, and that experience led to adopting more dogs and creating a kennel and expanding my experience on the trail with dogs. And after about 15 years, while I was doing research, as a matter of fact, on the Admiral Byrd 1928 expedition, I began a writing relationship via mail with Colonel Norman Vaughn, who, as you said, was the last surviving member of the 1928 expedition. And I was interested in meeting him. He had been sort of a hero of mine. I wanted the chance to interview him. And when I met him for the first time, I looked at him and I said, "Colonel Vaughn," I said, "you are the last living person who knew any of these dogs that I've been researching about. And I really want to talk more about your relationship with them." And that's how I came to meet Norman back in 2005, which was about 2 months short of his passing at age 100.
Now, with Norman, you had the opportunity, and there's your book, A Long Way to Nome, is loaded with beautiful photos about your dogs, which I just love. But more than that, you have photos about being involved with the ceremony. And you have a photo in here with yourself and Norman, which is very, very meaningful. And Norman passed away, I forget, I think it was in December of 2005, not all that long after his 100th birthday. And I can remember when I interviewed this man, when he was in his 90s. So many times when you have people that are older, when they're in their 90s, their voices are very frail. Not his. He had this strength, not just of character and personality. It just was a tremendous persona that came out through this voice. It was extremely rich and very vibrant. It didn't even quiver. It just was there.
Oh,
and
he's
just an incredible man.
He's a very robust man. And again, when I met him just 2 months before his passing at age 100, his voice was strong. His memory was quite amazing. And I even realized as I sat next to him, as we were looking at the photos of the dogs from the 1928 expedition and talking about them, that he did this without his reading glasses on. And he wrote a dedication in a copy of his book that he had written to me, and a little bit of a shaky hand, but his penmanship was still beautiful. And we spent hours together talking about the dogs, looking at video clips. And what I really remember is before we parted that day, and as my wife and I were excusing ourselves, my wife says to him, "Colonel Vaughn, well, we don't want to keep you too long and tire you." And he looked at her and he says, "Well, you would be the first," he said with a chuckle. And that just really addressed at the strength that this man had all his life.
He was an incredible personality, but he was that way from the time he was young. And I think that he had a persona, and the reason I wanted to share this persona with my audience is because this had a strong impact on you. Norman's persona was, okay, if I have to tough it out or if I have to do without, it's okay. I've got an objective in front of me. And I remember reading about him, and he was in his 20s. He was supposed to be going to college and becoming an academic. And he went against his entire father's objections. He said, "No, I'm going to go with Bird to the pole." And he slept in a gazebo out in the snow because there wasn't a place for him to stay, number one. But he said, "Hey, this will toughen me up because it's going to be pretty cold where I go." But his willingness to develop things, he developed the first portable dog food. I mean, there were just so many things this man accomplished, and he had two college friends that accompanied him. But his stamina and his dedication and his persistence and his determination is just amazing. When he went up to Alaska, he was broke. He was divorced. He didn't have anything, and he became an icon up there. People just loved him.
He really did. He overcame failure. He overcame adversity. He didn't know the word quit. And one of my favorite quotes from Norman, besides dream big and dare to fail, is the one where he says it goes something to the effect of, the only time you fail is when you quit trying.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so determined to make that trip to Antarctica, he actually went to Admiral Byrd, at that time Commander Byrd's home, and knocked on the door to introduce himself. And when he couldn't get to him at the front door, he went to the back door. He just would not take no for an answer, and he carried that determination throughout his entire life. I think he ran the Iditarod numerous times in his 80s.
Oh, yes, and he also decided he was going to climb a mountain at 88, Mount Vaughan, the one that was named after him, and
exactly.
And almost killed him.
And,
but
and
he was at that mountain. He went up that mountain.
Yes, and remember also that his first attempt was not successful. There was they suffered a catastrophic loss of a large airplane that crashed on the way there. Several dogs were lost. One of the members of the team was seriously injured. And there was doubts about whether they could, you know, ever go back and do this. And he says, we're going to. And the second attempt was almost more difficult in many logistical ways. But he saw it through. He kept that team together. And they got to the top of that mountain, I think, when he was 88 or 89 years old. Again, you know, like he says, you only fail when you quit trying.
Yes, and I can remember before I did my first interview with Norman when I was up in Anchorage, Alaska, and I was chatting with him. I didn't realize that, one, I didn't realize he was in his 90s because he wasn't an old man, not at all. And I didn't realize he did not have his legs, but that we were joking about how when he got to his 100th birthday, he and an associate, the bartender at Fletcher's Restaurant in Anchorage, Alaska, was chatting, and he said, Norman, if you plan on going up to Mount Vaughan, you better do it by a helicopter, because I sure as heck am not going to push you up there. you know, it's really, there was such a sense of humor there. I didn't realize how close to 100 he really was. Now, let's talk about the serum run, because that is what your book, A Long Way to Nome, is all about. Now, this I didn't realize that Norman had started. He had really wanted to have something that would honor and recognize the tremendous dedication of the dogs, the difficulty that occurred when there was a horrible, horrible breakout of diphtheria in a village. And this serum run was all about it. In fact, you have a photo in your book that says, Norman Vaughan Serum Run, Dream Big and Dare to Fail. It was an undelivered vial of the serum from the 2009 serum run that has been saved and that has been put there. But this was something you decided you were going to get involved with. Now, what made Norman decide that he wanted to put this together? And when did he do it, and why was it so significant to him personally?
Donna, that's a terrific question. Norman Vaughan came upon the idea of really finding a way to honor the original 20 Mushers and their extraordinary dogs who saved the village of Nome in 1925 from this diphtheria outbreak. And he wanted to do it in a way that ran mile for mile, the actual trail route, from the Nana, which is outside of Fairbanks, Alaska, 800 miles across the Alaska frontier, over a couple of mountain ranges and countless rivers, to the coast of Alaska, the village of Nome on the Bering Sea. And unlike the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, which is a competitive event from Anchorage to Nome, Norman wanted to run mile for mile the original 800-mile route, and more importantly, along the way, he wanted to actually stop at each of the approximately 13 villages along that route of native villages and bring something back to the people of Alaska. And what he decided they were going to do was to incorporate into this expedition along this route to honor the mushers. They would bring an education program each trip and change the program each trip to address the villagers. When we went in 2009, we had a little medical team with us. And the medical program that we presented at each of the villages was on stroke prevention. When we did it in 2011, the health education program was on suicide prevention. So Norman really wanted the way to make this journey without it being a competitive event for cash prizes. It wasn't a timed event. The objective really was to retrace the route, bring the spirit of those original 20 mushers back across Alaska, honor those villagers and villages who were the host of those original dog teams that went through there, and bring something back to the Native Alaskans in the way of health education.
Now, let's touch on the villages. There are many people today that are not aware that there are these small communities in these outlying areas, and that they really are cut off in many respects, not totally, but they're cut off from what many of us experience in everyday life. And so by your doing this during the dead of winter and interacting with them, it actually brings something very special into their lives. How have these villages changed through the years? Because there's been a significant alteration in their way of life, and some people even feel like it's not even necessary for them to keep up with their old ways because the world is much different than it was, let's say, 25, 30 years ago.
Oh, Donna, you put it beautifully. And here's something that I recognized in the villages when I got there. The old way of life of getting between the villages and relying on local transportation and hunting and fishing by dog team has been supplemented with the iron dog, the snow machine. And they bring mm-hmm. gasoline in by airplane. And most of the villagers today get around on their snowmobiles. I was really struck by the absence of sled dogs in those villages in the interior. And one of the reasons is they're very expensive and difficult to maintain. Keeping a dog team is not just a big commitment financially, but it's I think difficult for the Alaskan villagers now, so they've kind of drifted away from that and towards the iron dog. And it was really amazing to roll into one of these villages with our dog team and watch these villagers come out to greet you, from children to the oldsters, and to get to see their dogs and pet our dogs and help feed the dogs. And I remember that people would come by and an Alaskan native would look at me and say, you know, my grandfather used to have dogs like these. And it almost brought tears to your eyes to realize that here I was, an outsider from the lower 48, driving my dog team across Alaska and kind of bringing their heritage back to them. This wasn't my heritage. This was their heritage. And I was kind of bringing it alive to them to experience and see these dogs coming through their villages. And it was tremendously exciting for them to see these dogs.
There is so much about the Serum Run. And I'm trying to recall off the top of my head the Disney book, and I think there was a Disney movie made about the dog that was, I believe, the lead dog that had so much heart and was able to achieve, you know, to inspire the rest of the dogs. Let's talk a little bit about a team. I'll never forget the first time I saw huskies. This was up in Fairbanks, Alaska. And there was a dog truck, and of course it's all the crates all together so you can have your dogs. And I understood there were 18 to 20 dogs in this one truck. And every dog has its strengths, just like people. And some are meant to be leaders and runners in front, and others are meant to come up behind that have that consistent pace. But more than anything else, I was amazed at how small they were. I always had had the picture in my mind of these big, big dogs and these luscious, thick coats. And, of course, they could sleep in the snow, and they loved it because this was what they were bred for. They survived. They were hardy. And I looked at these dogs, and I said, holy Moses, these are not all that big. And I realized that they had trimmed the coats back because it was very, very warm. It was summertime. And the animals were more comfortable, apparently, without their heavy coats. But I learned also that these animals, they're born to run. They absolutely, these dogs have a heart for running that is incredible. So let's talk about the animals. Raising them. How do you determine what animals you're going to have, and what's the process for training for something like this?
Great. I love talking about the dogs, and I think people love hearing about dogs. First of all, these dogs, as you said, are born to run. It is in their instinct. It's built into their genes. These dogs, from the time they can get up and moving around, they want to run, and they want to run as a pack, and they love to pull. So this is something that they are born to do, and it's something they want to do, and a husky is never happier than when they're pulling. In the old days, in Alaska, in the interior, the dogs were a larger dog. More larger dogs were used. They were heavy-coated. They were hauling heavy freight. But over the decades and throughout racing, as racing has developed, the dogs have been bred to develop a husky that is that can maximize its speed over a long distance of trail in very cold environment. And it's evolved to the Alaskan husky today, which has really been around for decades and decades. But it's a dog that's 45 to 55 pounds typically. It has a medium coat. It can run up to 90 miles a day. It'll consume 10,000 calories a day on the trail. They have an amazing lifespan. On the Serum Run in 2011, I had a husky that turned 13 on that 800-mile run, and he was doing just fine every day. They're a well-conditioned dog. They're one of probably the world's greatest athletes. And as far as the team is concerned, if your listeners would think of any sporting team, basketball, football, soccer, these dogs all play a position in the team. And it's up to the coach, like any coach, to decide and evaluate each dog's character, personality, athletic skills, and find that position that dog will best play in or perform in. There's your lead dogs who are born to want to be out in front of the pack. They want to show the way. They may not necessarily be the strongest dog or the fastest dog, but they love to be out in front. They're great at picking out the trail and following the scent track. You've got swing dogs who are really fast dogs who like to set the pace for the team. You've got team dogs that are more comfortable just being in the middle of that pack and working really hard and being with their comrades. And it's up to the musher to really recognize that. So typically, dogs basically play a position, but you've got some who are cross trainers. You know, you've got a lead dog who can also do really well on the team. You've got a wheel dog who's back in front of the sled who can sometimes run well up front. But not every dog can be a lead dog, that's for sure. So it's up to the musher to really determine where the dog is happiest and performs the best in the team.
It costs $10,000 or more to take care of a team. I remember speaking with Susan Butcher's husband on a flight, and I had a good fortune of being able to sit with him, and I was educated on what Susan Butcher, who was a phenomenal musher, sadly she died of cancer, and she's dearly loved by the people of Alaska and people around the world because she was so skilled. Her animals and her care for her animals was first and foremost. But I know that it was in a remote area that they lived, and they had an 18-wheel rig that had to haul in food to feed their animals. And you just talked about how one of the dogs in a run, in a serum run, their they're needing 10,000 calories a day or more to be able to keep up their stamina. And they trained those dogs year-round, and it was quite an education that I received relative to Susan from Susan Butcher's husband. And when I was going through your book, you made that comment, and to get ready for the serum run, to get these animals in condition, you have to do the runs all the time so that they keep their stamina up. And, of course, they just love it. And Susan would be out every day, but they were very careful about what they fed their dogs. They were consistent. Of course, they had to get sponsorship because Susan was in the Iditarod frequently. But this was a full-time job. This was a real big deal, and she lost a race because she would not sacrifice her dogs. This was an incredible woman, and she set a standard that I just think is wonderful, and other women have participated. But when you were working with your dogs, what was it that you had to be aware of? Because you were involved in working with the animals for a long time, and you developed very strong bonds with all of your dogs. Every single one of your dogs. It reminded me of the way Susan did with hers. And this is something, the preparation. First of all, what's the training like for these dogs that you have to do? And how do you train yourself? I mean, you have to be physically fit yourself to participate in this kind of an event.
You do need to be physically fit, but those dogs, they're the true athletes. And I really like to stress that. Like, again, any sporting team, think of football, for example, for anyone who's had kids that are with a football program or associated with high school football, you know, you start that training just about after the school year begins. And that's, you're preparing weeks in advance. And it's really the same with sled dogs. Now, in the middle of summer here, it's in the 70s here, and my dogs get to play in the yard most of the summer. But as soon as the temperature's cool, they are anxious to hit the trail again. They start getting a little antsy, and usually by late September, no later than the 1st of October, we start short training runs on gravel roads where they're pulling a small-wheeled rig, and they are so excited to get back out on the trail. We just start with little training runs, just like you would with a sporting team. You kind of ramp your way up with mileages. We might go out and just do a 2-, 3-, 4-, 5-mile run, and the idea is that by December, you have these dogs conditioned so that they're happy and comfortable with a 25-mile run. By January, you can do 30, 40, 50-mile runs. So just like training any athlete, you're ramping up, you're watching the dogs progress. Your relationship with each of them is very special. One of my favorite quotes from a world-class musher, his name is Martin Bucer. He's an Iditarod musher. And someone asked Martin once, "Martin, who's your favorite dog?" And Martin said, "It's the dog I'm with at the moment. Whatever dog I'm with at the moment, that's my favorite dog." He's really in the moment with each animal. I think one of the things that any dog teaches their human counterpart is how to live in the moment. Dogs are always living in the moment, and they're not thinking about tomorrow. They've forgotten about yesterday. They're living in the moment. And when you experience that with an entire team of dogs, they really help you realize the value of just experiencing each moment, each day, and that works through your training program. And then when you do those long 800-mile runs, they're kind of keeping you in the moment of, let's just get to the next mile, let's get around the next turn. And that helps your mental conditioning, which is just as part as a big a part of success as your physical conditioning, is to be mentally prepared, and a big part of that is staying in the moment. Dogs are great at teaching that.
One of the wonderful aspects about your book, A Long Way to Nome, and we're going to be taking a break in just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk about this historical run that is done every year. Norman Vaughn was the initiator of it. Vaughn Martin is a man that is one of many that supports this and participates in it. But this is a complex process. When you go to do this run, I mean, you have photos of what you call the drop bag day. The Anchorage Airport receives just tons of material because there's drop points for food and for other things that are done. Now, this wasn't there when the original serum run happened. And this is incredible what we are doing today. But all of these photographs that you have in here, just the tons of items that have to be put into place, how important the Alaskan airline system is, because in many of these areas you can't get into them during the dead of winter other than by plane. And so pilots will bring this in, drop stuff off at certain points, and it takes a lot of preparation for this. And we will be coming back in just a moment to hear about this particular year and the challenges and the drama that went on. Donna Sebo here. My guest today is Vaughn Martin, A Long Way to Nome, The Serum Run, a part of American history that is quite incredible. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. My guest today, Vaughn E. Martin. We're talking about A Long Way to Nome, The Serum Run, and it was started by Norman Vaughn, as we have mentioned. Now, Vaughn Martin, he's participating in this serum run, and I believe the year was 2009. Am I correct, Vaughn?
Yes, that was my first participation.
I'm quoting exactly from your book a statement that you make. Fate already lurks in the shadows, guided by a full hand of misfortune that will soon deal bad luck, not only to our dogs, our snow machines, and several of the team members, but will deliver us calamitous weather and a trail from hell. Right there, that just says, it's amazing that you were even able to do it. And that's without getting into the drama that went on. Tell us briefly what it was that went on here that made these words that you put in your book a reality.
Wow, there was a lot of drama on that run. And really, there's a lot of drama on any long 800 or 1,000-mile dog team run across Alaska. As your listeners can only imagine the things that can happen out there to you, to your dogs. But in spite of the fact that I gathered 1,200 pounds of supplies and trained 12 huskies for hundreds of miles and made the trip to Alaska and spent months preparing and thousands of dollars, we got up there, and what we did not anticipate was being faced with the worst winter Alaska had had in about 30 years, I was told by a native Alaskan up there. And the team got pinned down roughly halfway on the serum run, maybe a third of the way across the serum run. We were pinned down by very heavy snow. In fact, I think it was up to 12 feet deep on the Yukon River where we were traveling. And snow machines were breaking down, engines were burning out. The trail actually became closed, and we got pinned in by the storm, and we were just unable to proceed. And it was really at that moment that we had to make a decision about whether we could safely expect our dogs to make the rest of this run or not. And that was one of the hardest decisions of my life and for our team.
Mm-hmm. And it was tough on everyone because there, as you said, there were a number of the machines, the snow machines. In fact, you had a gentleman that was supposed to join you at one point, and they couldn't find him. They couldn't find him. And this weather front had come in, and there was an elderly woman, and among the Alaskan natives, when the elders tell you, you don't do something, you listen, because they're relating to past experience. And there was this old woman who said, do not go a certain direction. She knew. And, of course, these people have learned through centuries how to relate to Mother Nature and those memories, and I think have even been passed along genetically to many of them. And the intuitive factor, and you found she was correct, because this storm came in, it was a blizzard of such immense density that it just paralyzed everything. I mean, the planes couldn't fly in.
Yes, it really did. It paralyzed Alaska that year, and it was really a wave after wave of blizzards. And at one point, we did something that had never been done on a serum run. In order to try to get past the bad section of trail and complete this mission, this expedition, and carry our ceremonial serum the rest of the way to Nome, we thought we would employ small bush planes to help us ferry or air portage our dogs over a bad section of trail, and which turned out to be one of the greatest adventures of that expedition. To cram up to 24 huskies in the cargo area of an airplane about the size of a dining room table for 12, along with two expedition sleds and all your supplies, and fly in a blizzard, you know, 100 miles down the trail and try to get past the bad section. And we relayed the dog teams, but the problem is we couldn't bring up our snow machine support behind us that was carrying a lot of the dog food and the camping supplies that we needed on the river, and we just couldn't, you know, work out the logistics against the weather. It just beat us that year.
Mm-hmm. It really did. And that's part of the, call it an adventure. When you're living it, if you don't look at it as an adventure, you're looking at just surviving. And when you think about the pioneers in 1925 that had the toxin, the diphtheria toxin, had been brought in by railroad. And in January of 27, 1925, that is when it was picked up. And then it was these teams of men and dogs that did this relay system that saved the lives of so many children that otherwise it wouldn't have been possible. They were too far removed. They didn't have anywhere near the technology we've got today. This is very moving, and here you are in 2009, for all of the technology being held down by Mother Nature, and just there's some things you cannot control, and this was one of them. This blizzard was a doozy.
It really was, and when we faced that weather and we were facing all that adversity with our dogs, I was really humbled even more by what those men had accomplished that we were there to honor. We were there to honor what they did in 1925 without high-tech clothing, without GPS navigation devices, without special modern harness designs for dogs and lightweight gear. They managed to relay that, you know, 30, 50 miles at a time between villages and get it to Nome because people's lives depended on it, and they just couldn't stop. And it was very humbling to realize that, you know, 75 years earlier or more that they had accomplished this in spite of the adversity they faced. I really recognized their achievement even more so.
Points that you bring out in your book between musher and dog that I think are exceptional. You were told by people that had a lot of experience with dogs to trust your dogs. And you found this to be the case, that your dogs were aware of directions to go. And if you tried making them do what they instinctively knew they should not do, you had problems. Learning to trust the dogs was just absolutely incredible. And I think that's one of the biggest gifts that we're given when we work with animals, to understand that intellect is not always cracked up to be what we promote it to be many times. And there are those levels of awareness that the dogs, for example, have that we can't possibly be aware of. And this is part of what makes your book so fascinating. And then Don Duncan, who is a master musher, you call him a musher extraordinaire, he said, you need to know this expedition you're going to take. It's going to include some of the worst experiences of your life, but it will also include some of the greatest experiences of your life. Now, this particular expedition, the story, the photographs in here, and I love the photo of Sleepy Girl that you have. She's on her back. She's in the snow. She looks like a cat. Her paws are up in the air, and she's just totally relaxed. She's just absolutely beautiful. And it was one of Don Duncan's Samoys. The photos that you have in here really give a realistic view of what you were experiencing at that time. Who was managing the camera, for heaven's sakes?
Well, thank you for asking. Well, I took pictures, and each picture in the book, and there's actually over 150 color photographs in this book, they're each cited as to what member of the expedition team took those photos. And then we just shared photo files at the end of the expedition. But I really wanted to bring the trip alive, not just through words and through excerpts from my audio journal that I kept along the way to kind of put the reader in the moment of the experience, but to give them a visual reference and context to the expedition by seeing pictures of these dogs in their elements, whether they're working in harness or, as you said, this dog just, she's on her back, she's sleeping in the sun in the morning, and just as content as she could be while she's off the trail.
Things happen quite unexpectedly, and you're working with circumstances that are new each day. It's about being innovative, accepting what comes, doing the best you can, and letting that be the legacy of this adventure. Boy, it's a personification of Norman's attitude. He always, I think, and just coming full circle to him because he initiated this originally, this is an attitude I think of most people that are adventurers. They say, this is the now. I want to do this in the now and living every moment in the now. Like you said, this is what the dogs taught you. Norman had this attitude. And I have to chuckle at your various stories about the dogs. I just loved it. One of them especially that I liked, it was Teak. You said he loved the movie, Eight Below, about dogs stranded in an Antarctic storm. And he, when you put the DVD in, he actually sits and watches the movie. That just really made me chuckle no end, because I've known of other dogs that'll do that with Animal Planet. And I just thought, this is really something. This dog seemed to really know that this was going to be his experience because he actually was part of this expedition.
Yes, yes, he was. And one of my favorite stories is when I recall that he had sat and watched that movie seven, eight times. And during the 2009 expedition, when we were evacuating the dogs and air portaging them from one village to the next, and we're in this tiny little airplane like in the movie, and there's a storm, like in the movie. And I remember picking him up, and he was the last of 24 dogs that I shoved into the last few inches that was left in the back of this airplane. And I put him in there, and the storm is howling around us. And I looked at him, and I said, Teak, well, you always loved that movie. Well, now you're in the movie. It's like he had almost created his own experience. And I closed the door, and off we went. And it was really an amazing circumstance of events, how it kind of came true for him.
For those of you listening, maybe you have never, ever seen or heard anything about mushing. Maybe you've never, ever been to Alaska. But there is a history in that state that's absolutely incredible. And one of the aspects of that history is the serum run that saved the lives of so many children of diphtheria, which we are hearing every once in a while stories about popping up somewhere. But it was a killer. Very definitely a killer, especially of children. This is a story of heroism, and it's being kept alive today by people like Vaughn Martin, so many others who do this adventure to just say it is still a challenge, And life is something that you have to take one day at a time. Vaughn E. Martin, your book is absolutely wonderful. The photography in it, the dogs, the stories about your relationship with your animals, the care for them, all of this. It's a way of experiencing the adventure in a significant manner, and I would think anybody would just really find it fascinating. And what a wonderful thing to share with younger people to help them realize that adventures are still out there to be experienced. Your book, A Long Way to Nome, you can find out more about it by going to callofthewildhuskies.com. callofthewildhuskies.com. Vaughn, thanks so much for being with me today. It has absolutely been wonderful. We're talking about something that takes place in the dead of the winter, in the middle of a hot summer that a lot of people are experiencing. The adventure is phenomenal. Thanks for putting it together.
Thank you.
It's been a delight having you on the show. Vaughn E. Martin, check out his book, A Long Way to Nome, The Serum Run 1925 Expedition. This is Donna Sebo. Check out callofthewildhuskies.com and find out more. We're going to take a break. We're going to be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. Oh, for those of you in the state of Washington, and maybe if you're outside of the state of Washington, I want to let you know about the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair. Now, this is an event. It's 15 years old, and it's happening. It's just wonderful. It's a fabulous family event. I'm going to be participating in it. This is at the Kelly Farm in Bonnie Lake, Washington, the first three weekends in August, which are just around the corner. I have some free passes. I have 9 passes left. I have 20, and I've only got 9 left. So if you would like to have a free pass, I want you to call me at my office, and that's 253-582-5604 so that I can get you this free family pass. It's for 2 adults and 2 children. It is a wonderful gift. And if you want to know more information about this terrific event, go to WashingtonFaire.com. Find out all the details. And if you want that free pass, hey, give me a buzz, 253-582-5604, so that I can get that pass out to you as quickly as possible. And I'm going to be there. I'll have my booth, look for the booth with the bright yellow banners with the big red lions on them. That will be hanging around my booth, and that's how you identify where I am. And I'm going to be having some items there, books, other things, and also I'll be doing little mini readings for people. Change. What do you feel about change? Do you like it? Well, sometimes we do, but many times we don't. We dig our heels in. Yes, we go, oh, I don't want to do this. I think about someone that I was talking with a short time ago. They were moving from the East Coast to the Southwest, and this was a big, big change for them. They really didn't want to do it. They felt that their life could possibly change for the worst. Just all kinds of fears came up. Well, if you're an individual, then you find that you're going to have to move, let's say a residence. Maybe your business has to move because of whatever is going on, and you're worried about this change. Well, Someone made a suggestion that I thought was a very good one. Have a special worry jar and make sure it's got a lid on it. And what you want to do, you want to write down whatever you're worried about. Just print it out in detail, your worst-case scenarios. Print it out. And then fold it up and put it in your worry jar. And then just let it go. The worry jar is holding all of that concern for you. Move on. Don't worry about it. I remember reading about someone, it was some famous person that had done something similar to this, and they said when they went back and looked at the things that they were worried, because they always dated whatever it was that they were putting in the jar, they said most of the stuff never even came to pass. But we're in the habit of this. We're trained to be worry boards. This is often what paralyzes us and you know, keeps us from moving forward. So also, when you're under a lot of stress, and I use this technique myself. When you're under a lot of agitation, maybe you haven't gotten enough sleep, or maybe you've got financial worries, meditation is a marvelous tool. And you don't have to do it for 45 minutes at a time. You can do it just for 2 or 3 minutes at a time. Maybe you're stuck in traffic and you're just getting all stressed. Oh, I'm going to be late. I'm going to be late. Take a deep breath and just breathe in and breathe out to the count of four. And you know what? Realizing that you have a choice about how you're going to respond to something. If you're in a situation you can't control, such as being stuck in the middle of a freeway, as it's happened to me, for 4 hours and only being able to move a foot at a time, then there's nothing much you can do about that. So breathe in, breathe out, and relax. Also, take time to have a break. We Americans are known as workaholics by many cultures around the world. We don't know when to turn off the activity. If we're sitting quietly and we're just enjoying something, many times we feel like we're wasting our time. We should be busy doing something. We're busy, 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 busy. Well, many times taking a break can really make a difference, and it can change your attitude. There was a very successful executive that made a point of having the equivalent of 2 months off every year. And he was questioned about it. Now, he had built a team, and this team would take care of things while he was gone. But he said he was more effective at problem solving when he backed away from the intensity and took a breather. Now, it didn't mean his mind stopped working, but he said, I had to step back many times, and by taking breaks, I came back to my work environment more refreshed, enabling me to assist and help others more effectively and efficiently. And he lived to be quite a ripe old age. So it's something that I think we need to remember, taking a break periodically. You could play whatever play is for you. It could be doing puzzles. It could be painting your garage, whatever it is. But taking a break really makes a difference. And then if you have a change checklist, that is something that really can work out for you. Let's say you've lost your job. All right, that's part of the change. That may open up a door of opportunity for you to go into something entirely different. I know there have been many situations in my life that when I looked at them and I thought, oh my goodness, this is terrible, absolutely terrible, what am I going to do? Kind of an attitude. Been there, done that? I bet you have. I know I have. Finally, when I would take a deep breath and say, okay, what can I do with this? If something has just gone awry, where do I go from here? And be open and receptive for serendipitous opportunities. And don't be afraid to talk to other people about what you think you might need. Let them know. When people are aware of your sincerity, they often will go that extra mile to assist you. But you have to let them know. People can't read minds. I mean, there might be a few out there, but in general, most of them can't. And they just assume that everything's hunky-dory because that's what you'll tell them. But it's not. So being honest about your challenges and saying, I'm open for ideas, and maybe brainstorming with some people that you know and respect are going to give you the tools that you need. Just really keep things simple as much as you can. Don't make it too involved. This is Donna Siebel. I'm so delighted you were able to join me today. We have a great guest tomorrow. We're going to be talking about Pearls of Wisdom with Asia Voigt. And We've got some delightful things that she's going to be able to share. I'm so pleased that we are able to spend this time together. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul, not somebody else. You are. Join me again tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on BBS Radio. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.